Hei, og velkommen til denne episoden av podcasten «Fra krise til håp». Når vi spiller inn denne episoden, går globaliseringskonferansen av stablen, og vi har derfor fått besøk av den brittiske økonomen Grace Blakely og lederen av Rethinking Economics I Norge, Marie Storli. I dette intervjuet så ønsker vi å se nærmere på to av de perspektivene innenfor miljøbevegelsen som ofte trekkes frem på venstresiden, nemlig Green New Deal og økologisk økonomi, eller degrowth-bevegelsen som det ofte kalles. Hva som egentlig forskjellen mellom disse, og om de bidrar til å ta seg skritt nærmere en løsning på klimakrisen, håper vi å få svar på gjennom denne studiosamtalen. Today, we're very excited to have two guests with us here in the studio. My name is Oda, and together with Sigrid.
Hi.
We will host today's episode. With us here in the studio, we have author and economist Grace Blakely, and the leader of Rethinking Economics, Norway, Marie Storli. Welcome.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for having us.
Grace, maybe you can start by introducing yourself.
Yeah, so I am a British, as you can probably tell, writer and political and economic commentator, and I write for the Tribune magazine in the UK. And I have two books out in the last couple of years. So the last one I wrote last year called The Corona Crash, How the Pandemic Will Change Capitalism. And before that, I wrote Stolen, How to Save the World from Financialization.
Thank you. And Maria?
Yeah, so my name is Maria. I'm educated and economist here at the University of Oslo. I finished my master's at the end of 2019, just before the pandemic hit. And since then, I've been the leader of Rethinking Economics in Norway. We work to what we call democratize the economic debate, so to explain in accessible terms what the economic debate is all about. And we also work to change the economics curriculum, that means what economists or the students learn, so what economists know, and in particular that they should learn other schools of thought, and you mentioned ecological economics, that is one of them. Thank you for having me.
The proposal of a green economic plan, or a Green New Deal, has been popular in many countries. And there has been a lot of discussion about the different variation. Perhaps the most well-known is the Green New Deal from the US, which has received a lot of criticism from the far right for being a cover for the left solution. In the UK, there has been a lot of talk about the Labour Green New Deal, which has received a lot more positive attention for being more progressive. The EU also has launched a Green New Deal that mostly focuses on governing the inner market. The idea of a Green New Deal has been popular in Norway as well. One of the reasons I think has been so well received is the fact that it creates hope and a sense of direction in a massive climate crisis. But here, as well as other places, it has been criticized for being yet another greenwashing project of the capitalist economy. Despite much of the criticism, a large sector of the European left continues to talk about the Green New Deal. First, Grace, could you explain to us what the Green New Deal is all about?
Yeah, so I think it's probably worth going into where this term originated. And it actually originated in the UK in the work of the New Economics Foundation after the financial crisis of 2008. So NEF, the New Economics Foundation, which is a UK think tank, kind of progressive think tank, brought together a load of kind of thinkers, politicians, intellectuals on, you know, the left, progressives generally, mainly from the UK, but some from more international perspectives as well. And they wrote this report looking at, you know, they called it this idea of the Green New Deal. And the argument was, right, we've had this big crisis. We've had this crash in 2008. We need to respond to it in such a way as to, yes, kind of create jobs and absorb the impact on incomes, but also in such a way as to, you know, decarbonize the economy over the long run. And this is a kind of classic, really Keynesian argument, right? It was that we were in the economy was in recession, the state had to step in to backstop demand, and they basically kind of attached this argument onto the end of it, which was, you know, and whilst the state is doing this kind of demand creating role, we need to make sure that investment is oriented towards decarbonisation. So rather than just, you know, Keynes famously said that the state could pay people to dig holes in the event of a recession like the one we had in 2008, whereas the Green New Deal economists were saying, well, why don't we pay them to kind of build wind turbines or, you know, solar panels or whatever. So that was kind of origin origin of this term, the Green New Deal. And it's very interesting the kind of the way that this idea has snowballed since then. Because at the time, it didn't really get very much pickup in the UK. You know, we had in many ways the opposite of that thinking taking place with the austerity agenda that was implemented by the Conservative Party, the coalition government in 2010, which really kind of, you know, stripped demand out of the economy. You saw massive cuts to investment and not really very much done on climate at all. It just wasn't really a hot button issue. So the kind of momentum then ricocheted across the Atlantic over to the US when you saw the kind of emergence of these new progressive politicians like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Squad, Bernie, and they took up this idea of the Green New Deal and said, right, we want to have this similar sort of thinking in the US, where you've had a much longer term just absence of investment, really. So it's quite easy for those campaigners to make this argument, right, we need to have a stimulus to kind of boost demand. It needs to deal with this long-standing infrastructure problem that we have. And also let's, you know, adopt this stance of decarbonisation at the same time. And it was really when you started to see big movements in both of these countries, in the US and the UK, and to an extent Europe, that the Green New Deal kind of became much bigger and much more powerful, and then came back over from the US back to Europe and the UK and became this rallying cry for these movements. You know, the movement around Jeremy Corbyn in the UK, obviously I've already mentioned in the US, the movement around Bernie Sanders, and kind of more socialist and progressive projects throughout mainly the periphery of Europe. And you kind of mentioned there that there are these differing perspectives as to what it means, right? Because, you know, Joe Biden says that he's doing a Green New Deal, but actually, you know, he's still not just allowing, but actually expanding offshore drilling as part of this, you know, big infrastructure project, which has been really gutted by a few quite right-wing Democratic senators in the US. You have the EU Green Deal, New Green Deal, or however they've decided to call it, which again, you know, does very, very little to deal with the kind of structural problems that exist within the Eurozone. And then you have what campaigners are pushing for, which, for example, at the moment we have things like the idea of the Global Green New Deal, which is being pushed by organizations like the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, which is much more radical, much more expansive. It's not just about, you know, a Keynesian stimulus project. It's about democratizing the economy. It's about resource transfers from global north to global south. And, you know, the labor program as well was much more far reaching and started even to consider things like ownership in the economy. So there's lots in some that is bundled into this one term, the Green New Deal. And we need to be very clear what we're talking about when, you know, we're advocating for this as a demand of a movement.
So tomorrow you will attend the conversation on the Norwegian Social Forum, or not tomorrow, on Sunday. It's called Why the Green New Deal Must Be Socialist. So in relation to that question, how can the Green New Deal confront the social and ecological crisis that today's capitalism has created?
Yeah, so I think I would put the mechanisms that are required within the Green New Deal to make it socialist, in inverted commas, or at least kind of, you know, socially democratic, into three main categories. The first is internationalism. The second is democracy. And the third is ownership. So internationalism, you know, the Green New Deal has to be global. We saw at COP, I don't know if anyone saw the Mia Mottley, who is the Prime Minister of Barbados, stand up and say, basically, world leaders have failed at COP and issue this challenge that low-lying and island nations need much greater investment, much greater access to financing. 1.5 degrees, let alone 2 degrees for these countries, will literally put some of them underwater. So we need much greater action. We need just a very basic level lending to these economies so that they're able to mitigate the impact of climate breakdown, as well as push for decarbonisation. We need technology transfers, so getting rid of some of the pretty regressive rules around intellectual property, for example, that prevent many of these states from being able to access the technology that they need to decarbonise. And we just need, you know, plain old resource transfers. We need, you know, some sort of form of climate reparations, some transfer of money from global north to global south to allow these states to not just decarbonize, but actually mitigate the impacts that they're already seeing. So there's internationalism. The second one is democracy. So I think this sits in a broader set of challenges that most economies in the rich world and actually globally are facing, which is just the massive decline in trust for democracy as inequality becomes so significant. So, you know, in many countries, the UK just being one of the most egregious examples, you increasingly see a small number of very, very powerful people making all the decisions about how the economy works, about who gets what. And this is kind of really eroding trust in our democratic institutions. And it's also allowing big business and vested interests to capture the process through which policy is made. So the argument for democratization is saying, let's put power back in the hands of the average person, both to make sure that we are restoring faith in democracy, but also to act as a counterweight to the interests of these powerful, you know, big oil fossil fuel companies. And then finally, there's ownership. So this is, you know, probably one of the most radical elements of it, which is just that, you know, a Keynesian approach might be to say we're going to tax, we're going to say introduce a carbon tax or something, and then have some level of investment undertaken by the state to, you know, basically transform infrastructure, maybe retrofit housing, this sort of stuff. But ultimately, when you have that sort of approach, a lot of the money that the state is spending ends up benefiting private businesses. So kind of taking a much more radical approach to ownership says, right, we're not just going to invest in infrastructure, in, you know, decarbonizing transport, utilities, etc. We're actually going to take those sectors of the economy back into public ownership. And again, linking that back up with these questions around democracy, making sure that the governance of, let's say, a nationalized railway or utilities service is democratic. So it's responsive to, you know, the needs of service users and the wider population. And that then represents a much more profound challenge to the interests of capital, particularly in somewhere like the UK, where you've had decades of privatization that, you know, basically have enriched a small elite at the expense of the entire country. So I think those three are just the basic foundations that you would need to make the Green New Deal progressive.
One of the main critiques from the climate movement is that the Green New Deal has been too focused on the transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy instead of focusing on like natural resources and having a more like holistic approach. I wanted to ask you, Maria, if you agree with this critique and how you see that dynamic between the degrowth movement and the Green New Deal.
Right. Yeah, it's a very good and I think important question. Like you said, there are different versions of the Green New Deal. Some are more ecologically progressive, if we can use that term. And the EU's Green New Deal is on the other side of the spectrum. That's all. It's a program rigged to ensure future economic growth. It's not, in essence, in order to ensure ecological sustainability. So it wants to take sustainability in as part of creating growth, but if you really read what they're saying, it's all about ensuring economic growth in the future. Up until now, the Norwegian debate on the Green New Deal has been quite focused on industries and renewable energy. There's term green industrialization, which I'm quite skeptic about. And in some sense, there are some truths in arguments that we need to build other industries. So in Norway's case, we do have a large petroleum sector. We produce a lot of oil and gas. And so obviously we have to phase out that production and start producing other things. So that is true. But we don't have the time to build up new export industries before we ask ourselves whether they are sustainable or not. So I think it's, what you're pointing to here, it's really important to take a holistic approach to sustainability and not only to look at the CO2 emissions, right? So we have this framework called planetary boundaries that defines 9 critical areas where climate change is only one of these spheres that are important for the Earth system to remain stable in the future. The loss of biodiversity is, by many scientists, considered a much more dramatic problem than climate change is. Not to say that climate change isn't important. It's really, really important, and we don't have a lot of time. But we also don't have a lot of time to stop the mass extinction. Some people talk about a sixth mass extinction. So that's the loss of biodiversity. So there's this division between people that want to build renewable energy quickly, build green infrastructure, and do these things to solve the climate crisis, and those that want to talk about sustainability on a broader, in a broader sense. I think part of this is tied to the problem that we have with mainstream economics, that mainstream economics does not consider natural resources as a fundamental or essential part of economic production, which of course it is. So that's an ecological criticism of mainstream economics, that nature does not feature in what is the production function. Mainstream economics sees production as the result of labor or workers and machinery. And then you kind of jump or you ignore the fact that natural resources are fundamental to both labor and machinery, and then also goes into that production in a lot of value chains. So ecological economics gives us another starting point to think about the economy. Ecological economics places nature at the focus of economic analysis and says everything starts with natural resources. Within the borders of the natural system, we have society, that is one system, and then the economy is a subsystem of these two. So the economy depends on society, what kind of institutions that we have, and society depends on what kind of resources are available for us in nature. Ecological economics also deals more directly with matter and energy and provides, in my opinion, a useful or maybe necessary kind of frame to think about these things, which are going to be particularly important when we move into that discussion on circular economy that's by a lot of people presented as this grand solution to all the things and also an essential part of the Green New Deal. And also here, there are a lot of actors that are saying that circular economy is the main tool that we can use in order to ensure growth in the future. But in ecological economics, it's built on what is called the laws of thermodynamics. It's from physics, so it's a little bit an advanced way of saying that all matter will be worn. So you can picture if you buy a pair of sneakers, right? They will be really white and shiny when you buy them. And then when you wear them, they can not get kind of better. They can only be more worn. And if you at some point want to upgrade your sneakers, you will have to put in energy or matter in order to fix them back to maybe the state they were in when you bought them, or maybe to make them even better if you put some glitter on them or whatever that makes you happy. So that is to say that there are no quick fixes in the circular economy either, because we will always need matter and energy into those processes.
I think it was a very good description.
And like the sneaker one.
Then. Yeah, I can really like see my sneakers now with the glitter on them. Yeah. Looks so nice. We have seen this, I think, several times, that like there will often be a conflict of interest between, between different groups when new industrialized projects are being implemented. And several of the Green New Deal projects and like the left-wing solutions to the climate crisis are based on renewable energy, which is often like it often requires minerals or other natural resources, which has to be extracted from somewhere. And we can see an example of this in Norway right now, where we have the mining project in Repparfjorden in the north of Norway, where a company called Nussir ASA, they want to establish this like gold and copper mine. And the project is in fierce conflict with the local population, the indigenous Sami population, and environmental organizations. So, of course, we don't expect both of you to be like very familiar with this case, but it's a good example of this type of conflict between, if we can say, like between the environmental and the climate aspect of the struggle. So when we know that we will see more of these types of conflicts in the future, my first instinct would be that like this ecological approach might be like necessary to avoid these sort of conflicts. But what do you both think about that?
As I just talked about the circular economy, now I just want to jump in there, because part of the circular economy is about reducing waste, and part of it is about reducing our dependency on fetching new resources from nature. So an important thing that we could do in Norway, because we throw away a lot of electronic stuff every year, I forgot the numbers now, but they've been circulating for a while, it's a lot of things that are sent out of the country. Usually it lands somewhere in the south and is not taken care of in a decent way. So these minerals that go into chips are obviously in the electronic waste. So what we need to do is to start to pick those things apart.
Yeah.
Thank you. So that's obviously one solution to it. Then if that is the whole solution, I'm not sure, but that is the start.
Yeah, I mean, I think my starting position in any of these discussions is to start thinking about power and who has power in the global economy, who has the power to decide which solutions end up getting adopted and which solutions don't. Because I think, you know, we've now reached a point where basically most of global capital recognizes that there's going to need to be some sort of transition towards a lower carbon economy. The question is how we get there. And of course, that question of how we get there is not really going to be determined by abstract policy debates. It will be determined by who's in charge, who has the power. And, you know, at the moment, we live in an economy in which power is highly concentrated in the hands of a very small number of large and powerful corporations, a small number of large and powerful financial institutions, and a small number of large and powerful states. A great example of this is obviously Bolivia, where you see a lot of kind of natural resources that are required, lithium being the most obvious, to put into the batteries of electric cars. That's where a lot of those resources come from. And of course, very famously last year, when this coup removed a kind of socialist and progressive leader who had the backing of a lot of the indigenous population of Bolivia, a kind of right-wing leader ended up, you know, pushing him out. And Elon Musk of Tesla, which obviously uses a lot of this lithium, says we will coup wherever we like in our search for these natural resources. And I think that really captures the dynamics of power that we see at the global economy when we are thinking about sustainability, because you have an incredibly, incredibly powerful man, Elon Musk, who is one of the wealthiest men in the world, going up against a prime minister of a country that is in the global south and whose support comes from indigenous populations that are really at the kind of bottom of the global hierarchy when we think about, you know, who has the power. At the moment, unless we are able to build a counter movement that is able to take on the power of people like Elon Musk, that's able to take on the power of American empire, unless we're able to do things like what, you know, Bolivian people were able to do when, you know, they really challenged the system, then these decisions have been made for us, right? So it's not enough just to say, well, we should be doing X, Y, or Z, unless we can build a political movement that says we will do X or Y or Z, then there's not really a lot we can do. And I think we can learn a lot actually from the way that indigenous people organize and mobilize to resist the exploitation of natural resources in the places that they call home, whether that's in, you know, whether that's in North America or South America or various other parts of the world. Because the places where that resistance has been successful are places where lots of different parts of the movement for climate justice have come together and have used a lot of different tactics. So as well as these kind of electoral political tactics that see people like Evo Morales get into power, you've also seen disruptive tactics at, you know, the grassroots level. You've seen, you know, activists get in the way of pipelines, kind of, you know, use much more, disruptive tactics, basically to kind of get in the way of these circuits of global capital. And I think that's really where the discussion needs to move next. It's less about, for me personally, abstract conversations about how we're going to undertake this transition. And it's more about making sure that, you know, the decisions that we are taking are in the interest of the vast majority of people on the planet. And that requires, as I said, us to think about strategy and tactics as well as questions of policy. So for me, the big thing that we have to do before we start thinking about anything else is think, how do we build a cohesive international movement that aims towards, yes, tackling climate breakdown, but also undermining and subverting the power of the people who make all of the decisions in the global capitalist system.
Yeah, definitely. I see what you're saying, and I, to a very large degree, agree with you as well. And also being a part of that movement in protest of this mining company. It was a very big gathering, and we also had an episode about that last month on how different movements came together and made a very functioning and effective coalition that was really, really good. But at the same time, we had this discussion about, okay, but the minerals, we need the minerals, we also want to like green the economy or green the energy system, and we kind of need to do that at the same time. And it was very interesting being in an environment where this was supposed to happen, but also where you had an environmental movement talking about solution to new types of energy, which is also needed in a country like Norway, where oil is like the main thing. You know, Norway as like fairly democratic society, it is impossible, at least it feels like that, to make us not have an oil-dependent economy. And then it feels also hard, like, how can we change it other places when we cannot change it here?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the big problems there is that this is why progressive movements always end up stalling. It's because before we've even got to the point of being able to influence the tiniest corner of society, we've already torn ourselves apart with disagreements as to how we would manage society when we get into power. And of course, the fact that we're having those disagreements before we have any power is what's preventing us from taking power in the first place, right? So I think there is a set of strategic and tactical questions here about what's getting in the way of us actually just getting down there and stopping them building new pipelines, stopping people from like actually extracting these resources, like what is getting in the way of us building an expansive and coherent political movement that allows us to kind of set the agenda and win support for these policies. And then there is obviously that second set of questions, which is what you just mentioned, which is how do we get to the point where we can convince people that some of this stuff is actually possible and desirable? And I think that's a much more profound question because it really comes down to the ways that the kind of material structures that govern global capitalism are linked to the way that we think about the world, think about society, think about capitalism itself. You know, I think the reason, one of the main reasons perhaps that establishment voices in the UK and the US pushed back so hard against, you know, resurgent socialist movements that came about over the last 5 years was because they really started to challenge that idea that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. They started to really make people believe that change was possible and it was not possible to organize society in completely different ways than the ways that we organize it now. So rather than having a society where, you know, every decision is centered upon profit maximize, or what's going to maximize profits for a small number of people at the very top, having a society in which decisions are taken democratically, in which everyone has a stake, and in which, you know, we understand ourselves as part of a broader society, as part of society which is itself an ecosystem, and where we're all kind of mutually dependent upon one another. Now, that comes down to, I think, a big problem that we have within social movements right now. It's because the way that we conceive of ourselves and our identities is very linked to the kind of capitalism that we have today, i.e. it's individualistic, it's competitive, it's about, you know, which segment of the movement is winning out over which other segment. And we don't really have that sense of, you know, solidarity and kind of democratic methods of organizing that would allow us to actually say, right, well, you know, we all want the same thing here. Why don't we just have a conversation about it? And even if we don't agree on, you know, everything, actually be able to come together to put some of these tactics into action, because that's really what matters.
I like what you're saying, that we need to agree on some things, but maybe one way of doing it is that we don't have to agree exactly on what the solution is, because there isn't one solution for everyone. But we need to agree on what direction we're going in, for sure. And then to have it more decentralized, in order to make systems more democratic, then let decisions be decentralized so that people can talk to each other and agree on what is the best way of doing it, instead of sitting here trying to figure out what is the best way, because there is no answer to that. But I think the economic model we're coming from was very much built on this idea that there is one solution to all the questions. And now we might have to leave that, and that feels a little bit frightening for a lot of people, that there is not one, you know?
And I think also what you said about tactics, and also like how there is no one solution, but there is not only one tactic, which is a topic that is very hot these days in Norway. Social movements necessarily don't want to do the same thing and act in the same way, which is like, ooh, a bit new for us, I think. And a lot caused a lot of debate and like, is it the right way to go about? And I think maybe just leaving that right way thinking around change might help us a little bit.
You know, there are legitimate and important disagreements between different elements of a movement based on the fact that different people have different experiences of the economy, come from different parts of the world, come from different parts of society, and therefore have important disagreements. There are also disagreements that come from the fact that a movement is a source of power, and whenever there is an entity which is a source of power, you get people who want to control it and want to kind of have their fiefdom and have their kind of area of influence. And I think we need to be really careful that we're not allowing those, you know, competitive individualistic dynamics to overtake you know, the much broader project, because that is historically what the left has done over and over and over again throughout history. I think we need to be much more attentive when those dynamics emerge. So when we start seeing, you know, people setting up disagreements that don't necessarily need to be as deep as they are, in order to kind of basically carve people up, whilst also recognizing that there will be disagreements and we need to be able to come up with much more cooperative and, yeah, kind of democratic ways of being able to debate between different perspectives.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's such a good example of how, like, capitalism has influenced how we just view, like, society and interhuman relations. And to build a bridge over to something completely different that is also calling of capitalist structures, then I was wondering if you had something to say about the continuous resource extraction from the global south. I was wondering now that if we, like, imagine that we will be able to actually go in, like, a more ecological direction with our policies, then how do you see this in, like, the global context? How will the global south be involved in our development?
I think that it's too simplistic to say either we can decarbonize without any of these resources, or to say that it doesn't matter how we acquire these resources, we need them to decarbonize, so we'll get them. You know, imagining a completely different world economy than the one we have now, because the model that I'm proposing will not be possible. Let's just put that out there on the table now, as long as we have an economy governed by the principles of capitalism and profit extraction, because, you know, as long as that exists, then companies will just go and take those resources for as long as it is profitable for them to do so. So unless we're taking on the interests of global capital, it's in many ways a kind of moot point. But let's say that we kind of get towards a system in which we're able to, like, stop that from taking place. I think, again, the question has to come down to democratic ways of determining how these resources are used. So that would be, let's say, if we're talking about lithium in Bolivia, you would have to have mechanisms for allowing indigenous communities to engage with other areas of civil society to develop a plan, a democratic, decentralized plan for saying, these are the resources that we have available to us. These are our decarbonization needs. These are the decarbonization needs of the rest of the world. How can we think about ensuring that our needs for, you know, stewardship, careful stewardship of, you know, the natural environment and of ecology much more generally can be balanced with the need to ensure that we don't get to catastrophic levels of warming, and therefore that we will need some mechanism to ensure that we are able to produce energy, you know, in a world that doesn't rely completely on fossil fuels, and particularly actually that parts of the world that do still need to develop, that do still need to see rising incomes, are able to do that and don't have to ask their populations basically to kind of just rely on the generosity of countries in the global north, but that actually they're able to continue to be able to develop whilst also decarbonizing. So, you know, I don't think it's often set up as this simplistic dichotomy, and I don't think it is.
Mm. So from my perspective, an important starting point for that conversation is that the global north needs to pay back part of the wealth that we have built in our part of the world on resources from the global south. Usually when we talk about the South, and I mean, not at the Globaliseringskonferensen, but in the general debate in Norway, it's always very much based on this idea that we do a lot of things to help the South. Mm-hmm. But we need to start from the different perspective. We are greatly indebted to the South. We've taken resources from them. And like you said, we need to pay climate reparations, but also reparations for a lot of other things that we've done. And then I think in terms of the Green New Deal, so the Green New Deal is built on this idea that we have to do something radically about sustainability, but it's also built on ideas that are called modern money theory. It's also a movement of economists that describe how the state can use money as because money is a public good. So you can the state can use its money because the state has monopoly over its own money to create public good for its population. We need to also then talk about the fact that countries in the global south are not able to do this because they have debt in foreign currencies. So the most important thing that we can do is actually to erase this debt and allow them monetary sovereignty so that they can choose the development strategies that they want. Right, but right now they are forced into certain institutional arrangements by the IMF that are not helping them. And it's also based on the idea that there is one development strategy that's going to fit for everyone. But what we're saying here is that there is no one solution. They all have to develop locally.
Yeah, I think we have a lot to do here in Norway with our pension fund and our trade agreements. Mm. We can definitely help out a lot by like quitting our investments in bad projects, the pension fund that we have says that there is not enough good projects in the world for them to invest in, and that's why they're investing in a lot of bad stuff. It's not their fault.
And that is an interesting perspective, though, because it speaks to this deep crisis of global capitalism that there actually aren't enough good projects for people to invest in. That's why, you know, at the macro level, the absence of sources of investment that look like they'll be viable over the long run is why Amazon, Tesla, a few massive monopolies, a few big energy companies are absorbing all of that investment, along with like cryptocurrency and all these kind of weird, arcane new asset classes. Basically, because like a bunch of the things that we've been putting our money into up until now are completely unviable, and we're not doing anything. We're not creating any new, you know, projects or source of investment that that could absorb that capital, which is a very big problem.
Then I think we're like starting to come to an end. Do you have any final comments or thoughts that you want to share? You can start, Maria.
So I have, to go back to a little bit this Green New Deal, I think it is very exciting that a lot of people are pushing for these sorts of programs right now. But I am a little bit worried about where this is going to go. And I just want to like air my my worries a little bit, because like you described in the beginning, so the idea is to put people to work to solve. So we solve the social crisis and the ecological crisis using then state money that is built on this idea of modern money theory, right? But the Green New Deal and the New Deal in the 30s was very much built on this, that we had this situation where inflation was low and unemployment was high. Now, unemployment is not that high in Norway, so it's not necessarily that relevant for us to think about that. But the ability of the state to spend money in that way is very much reliant on what is happening with inflation. And right now we're in a kind of interesting environment where inflation is really high in some sectors while not in others. I'm not saying that that should stop us from building or investing in nature and a low carbon economy and that sort of thing, but that we might meet economists that will say, no, this is impossible because now inflation, so prices in the electricity market is rising really high, right? They will be high for another year, probably. That will then spill over into other sectors and we will see increasing prices. And we have to think about how we're going to work our way around that and not let that stop the call for a Green New Deal.
I certainly agree with a lot of that. And I think what it speaks to is really just the inadequacies of the market system for being able to coordinate the transition to zero carbon. We need some form of plan, really, because, I mean, what we're talking about when we're talking about inflation is, it's easy to think of inflation, you know, inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon, as the monetarists would say, but it's, you know, it's actually a question of resources, where they are, how they're being used, where they're being held up. So being able to kind of, you know, take stock of the resources that we have and try and use the resources that we have in the best ways possible to tackle climate breakdown, that's something that requires a level of planning, and I would argue democratic and decentralized planning. Even before any of these issues come up, my big worry at the moment is how, you know, progressives are going to win the battle on, the political battle on climate breakdown. Because for a long time, we've basically taken for granted the fact that doing anything about climate breakdown is inherently progressive, because, you know, we've had climate denialists on the other side of the aisle. And yet today we're seeing not just global capital basically saying, right, we have to do something about climate breakdown. And what they mean, by the way, is we have to make sure that climate breakdown doesn't impact profits. So there are plenty of solutions to climate breakdown, solutions in inverted commas, that could be undertaken without threatening the interests of capital that take place within a capitalist economy, but which would basically deepen and exacerbate inequalities that already exist within the global economy. So it would basically mean allowing low-lying and island nations to basically be submerged, like desertification to proceed apace, and millions of people all around the world just to die or to be unable to survive whilst protecting assets that exist in the global north. And then we have, even further to the right, a kind of terrifying dystopian vision of the response to climate breakdown, which is like people like Marine Le Pen saying, well, climate breakdown means climate refugees, so what we need to be doing is building borders everywhere. And I think the left has become a bit complacent. We're spending a lot of time thinking, what should we be saying? What are the policies going to be? Like, what's our plan to tackle climate breakdown? We're not thinking about how we're communicating this message whilst the rest of the population are being exposed to these two other messages, which is like, this thing is here, it's terrifying, we need to do something about it, you need to give me, far-right politician or representative of the capitalist class, your vote so that I can protect you from this thing, climate breakdown. And us on the left over here are saying, well, should we, you know, have this target or that target when we eventually get power and change the world economy, right? So my big worry is, even before we get to all these questions around policy, is how are we communicating? How are we building support for progressive decarbonization? And how are we, building a movement that is actually able to kind of not just take power electorally, but disrupt the ongoing like devastation of the climate that we're seeing all around the world?
I wish we could talk about this for ages. I think it is so much fun. But unfortunately, we have to wrap it up. So thank you so much for coming. I will also say thank you to Sara, who was our producer. We would also like to say thank you to Manifest for providing us with this very nice studio. Check out Grace's podcast, A Wall to Wind. And if you're an economist, join Rethinking Economics.
Du har hørt podcasten Fra krise til håp fra Norges sosiale forum. Har du spørsmål til denne episoden, kan du sende det til podcast@globalisering.no. Flere episoder hører du der du hører podcasten.